vote. According to the Constitution, the House must approve by majority vote the articles of impeachment, which are similar to a criminal indictment of a federal official. The articles are then sent to the Senate for trial. Although a jury in a criminal trial must be unanimous for a guilty verdict, only a two-thirds majority of the Senate is required for conviction and removal from office. The Constitution reserves impeachment as a remedy for only the most serious of offenses: treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. David Kendall asked for an advance copy of Starr's referral so that he could draft a response. Starr refused. On September 9th, Starr's deputies drove two vans to the Capitol steps and delivered copies of the over 110,000-word Starr report, complete with 36 boxes of supporting documents, to the sergeant-at-arms. Starr's piece of grandstanding was appalling. The quick decision by the House Rules Committee to make the entire report available on the internet, even more so. Federal law requires that grand jury evidence be kept confidential so that testimony elicited by a prosecutor from a witness without the clarifying effect of cross-examination cannot prejudice a case or harm an innocent person. The Starr report was a compilation of raw grand jury testimony obtained from witnesses who were never cross-examined and released to the public without regard to fairness or balance. I have not read the Starr report, but I've been told that the word sex or some variation of it appears 581 times in the 445-page report. Whitewater, the putative subject of Starr's probe, appears reportedly four times to identify a figure like the Whitewater Independent Counsel. Starr's distribution of his report was gratuitously graphic and degrading to the presidency and the Constitution. Its public release was a low moment in American history. Starr recommended that the House Judiciary Committee consider 11 possible grounds of impeachment. I was convinced that he had overstepped his legal authority. And the more I believed Starr was abusing his power, the more I sympathized with Bill, at least politically. Starr's list of impeachable offenses included charges that the president lied under oath about his personal behavior, obstructed justice, and abused his office. Bill never obstructed justice or abused his office. He maintained that he did not lie under oath. Whether or not he did, a lie under oath about a private matter in a civil suit was not grounds for impeachment, according to the vast majority of constitutional experts and historians. The day after Starr delivered his report to the Congress, Bill and I attended a Democratic Business Council reception, where I introduced him as my husband and our president. Privately, I was still working on forgiving Bill, but my fury at those who had deliberately sabotaged him helped me on that score. For weeks, Bill had apologized to me, to Chelsea, and to the friends, cabinet members, staffers, and colleagues he had misled and disappointed. At a White House prayer breakfast with religious leaders in early September, Bill offered an emotional admission of his sins and a plea for forgiveness from the American people, but he would not give up his office. He cast his political fate with the American people. He asked for their compassion and then went back to work for them with the same commitment that he had brought to his presidency from his first day in the White House. And we continued with our regular counseling sessions, which forced us to ask and answer hard questions that years of nonstop campaigning had allowed us to postpone. By now, I wanted to save our marriage, if we could. The public response to Bill's forthright apologies raised my spirits. The president's job approval was holding steady through the crisis. My own approval rating was nearing an all-time high. Although the case for an impeachment was both unpopular and unjustified under the constitutional standard, I assumed that the House Republicans would pursue it if they thought they could. The only way to avoid impeachment was through a strong showing in the November elections. But Democratic candidates everywhere were feeling justifiably nervous about the president's political health. On September 15th, a delegation of about 24 Democratic congresswomen met with me in the yellow oval room. The representatives sat on couches and chairs while butlers served coffee and pastries. The women had come to urge me to take a public role in the upcoming election. But I think they also wanted to see and hear for themselves how I was holding up and what I was planning to do next. Once they realized that I was serious about standing up for the Constitution, the President, and the Democratic Party, they asked me to get out and campaign for them. "I'll help you in any way I can," I said, "but I also need you to help hold the party together and to keep the Democratic caucus members where they belong, behind the Constitution and the President." Campaigning in dozens of congressional races, my frenetic schedule kept me occupied all day. But the nights were difficult, especially after Chelsea returned to Stanford. Bill and I had only ourselves, and it was still awkward. I didn't avoid him as I had before, but there was still tension between us, and not as many shared laughs as I was used to on a daily basis with my husband. I spent a lot of time alone, praying and reading. It was a welcome distraction when my good friends, Diane Blair and Bessie Johnson Ebeling, came to stay with me for a few days in mid-September. On September 17th, during Diane and Betsy's visit, Stevie Wonder called and asked if he could come over to see me at the White House. He had attended the state dinner for another of his fans, Czech President Havel and his new wife Dagmar, the night before, and he wanted to return privately to play a song he had written for me. Capricia escorted Stevie, his assistant, and one of his sons into the second-floor corridor of the residence, where a grand piano stood under a large painting by Willem de Kooning. Diane and Betsy sat on a settee and I sat in a small chair near the piano as Stevie began to sing a haunting, lilting melody. He hadn't finished all the words, but the song was about the power of forgiveness, with the refrain, "You don't have to walk on water." As he played, I kept moving my chair closer to the piano until I was sitting right next to him. When Stevie finished, tears filled my eyes, and when I looked around, tears were running down Betsy's face and Diane's. This was one of the kindest gestures anyone made during this incredibly difficult period. I was also touched when Vogue editor-in-chief Anna Wintour called to propose an article and photo shoot for the December issue of the magazine. It was gutsy of her to offer, and counterintuitive for me to accept. For a day, I escaped into a world of makeup artists and haute couture. The Annie Leibovitz photographs were great, giving me the chance to look good when I had been feeling so low. September 21st, the day Bill addressed the opening session of the United Nations in New York, played out like an absurdist farce. When the Star Report didn't force Bill to resign, the Republican leadership upped the ante and released the president's videotaped grand jury testimony. As Bill entered the enormous General Assembly Hall of the United Nations, he was met by an enthusiastic and unusual standing ovation. At the same time, all of the major television networks were broadcasting a tape of his August interrogation by Starr's deputies. As the hours of agonizing testimony droned on over the airwaves, Bill gave a forceful speech to the UN about the growing threat of international terrorism and the urgent need for a united response from all civilized people. I'm sure few Americans heard Bill's warning. By the time we returned to the White House the next day, it looked as if the Republicans' publicity stunt had failed. The spectacle of the president keeping his composure while being barraged with prurient questions that no one would want to answer seemed to create more sympathy among the American people for Bill's predicament. The following evening, Nelson Mandela, who had also attended the UN session, visited us at the White House with his wife, Graca Machel. At a reception for African-American religious leaders in the East Room, Mandela spoke about his genuine love and respect for Bill. After praising the relationship Bill had forged with South Africa and the rest of the continent, Mandela noted gently, "We have often said that our morality does not allow us to desert our friends." He turned to Bill and addressed him directly. "And we have got to say tonight, we are thinking of you in this difficult and uncertain time in your life. If our expectations, if our fondest prayers and dreams are not realized," he said, "then we should all bear in mind that the greatest glory of living lies not in never falling, but in rising every time you fall." I was still trying to rise. By seeing each hour through to the end, and starting over every morning, I was rebuilding my life imperceptibly, one day at a time. It was a challenge to forgive Bill. The prospect of forgiving the hired guns of the right wing seemed beyond me. If Mandela could forgive, I would try. But it was hard, even with the help of many friends. Some weeks after Mandela's visit, the Dalai Lama called on me at the White House. At our meeting in the map room, he presented me with a white prayer scarf and told me he thought often of me and my struggle. He encouraged me to be strong and not give in to bitterness and anger in the face of pain and injustice. On October 7th, a delegation of freshman House members came to see me in the White House. Once again, we met in the yellow Oval Room as sunlight streamed through the windows. They were worried that the Republicans would force an impeachment vote before the midterm election. I gave the best pep talk I could. "We can't let them hound the president out of office," I said. "Not like this. You're members of Congress. Your job is to protect the Constitution and do what's right for the country. So let's walk through this." The consensus among Democrats and the few remaining moderate Republicans on the Hill was that censure, a vote of reprimand, would be the most appropriate response to Bill's behavior. But powerful Republicans were adamantly opposed to the compromise. Henry Hyde, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, derided the notion of censure as impeachment light. He blamed the White House for a September 16th piece in Salon, an internet magazine, that reported that he had carried on a lengthy love affair during the 1960s while he was married to his late wife. Hyde called his infidelity, which took place when he was in his 40s, a, quote, youthful indiscretion. Despite my many political and ideological differences with Hyde, I was sympathetic to his distress, though mystified that he didn't see the double standard in his reaction. I spent the fall crisscrossing the country on a campaign marathon. I urged people to vote as if their lives depended on it. I poured my heart into Representative Charles Schumer's campaign to defeat New York Senator Al D'Amato. An intelligent and doggedly progressive Democrat, Chuck Schumer was one of Bill's most steadfast supporters. D'Amato had chaired the Whitewater hearings in the Senate, where he had paraded blameless White House secretaries, ushers, and a babysitter in front of the committee, finding nothing but saddling them with legal bills. D'Amato was vulnerable to Schumer's vigorous challenge. As voting day approached, the GOP launched a massive ad campaign that focused on the scandal. The scheme was unsuccessful. Voters seemed to be more disgusted with Republican tactics than even with the president's behavior. On election day, the exit polls started coming in, and Bill was in an upbeat mood. As always, I was too nervous to watch the returns, so I invited Maggie and Cheryl Mills, a top-notch lawyer in the counsel's office, to join me in the movie theater for a screening of Oprah Winfrey's new film of the Toni Morrison novel, Beloved. When we emerged later that night, there was good news. The vote was historic. Democrats gained 5 seats in the House and narrowed the Republican margin. It was now 223 to 211. The Senate held steady at 55 Republicans to 45 Democrats. Barbara Boxer won re-election to the Senate, and the best news of the night was that Chuck Schumer beat Al D'Amato in New York. Republicans and pundits thought Democrats would lose up to 30 House seats and 4 to 6 Senate seats. Instead, Democrats won seats in the House, the first time since 1822 that a president's party had done so in his second term. Another surprise soon followed. 3 days later, Friday, November 6th, Senator Moynihan taped an interview announcing that he would not run for a fifth term. The interview was to be aired on Sunday morning, but the news leaked early. Late on Friday night, the White House operator patched through a call from Charlie Rangel, the veteran congressman from Harlem and a good friend. "I just heard that Senator Moynihan announced he is going to retire. I sure hope you'll consider running, because I think you could win," he said. "Oh, Charlie," I said, "I'm honored you would think of me, but I'm not interested. And besides, we have a few other outstanding matters to resolve right now." "I know," he said, "but I'm really serious. I want you to think about it." He may have been serious, but I thought the idea of running for Senator Moynihan's seat was absurd, although this wasn't the first time it had come up. A year earlier, at a Christmas reception at the White House, my friend Judith Hope, the chair of the New York Democratic Party, mentioned that she didn't think Senator Moynihan would run again. "If he doesn't," she said, "I wish you would run." I had thought Judith's comment was far-fetched then, and I still thought so. I had other things on my mind. The 1998 midterm election produced yet another surprise when Newt Gingrich stepped down as Speaker of the House and announced that he would resign from Congress. At first, this seemed like a victory for our side and the likely derailment of impeachment. Bob Livingston of Louisiana was set to succeed Gingrich as Speaker, but Tom DeLay, the majority whip, and the real power in the Republican caucus, pressured the Republicans into opposing any reasonable compromise, such as a censure vote. The Whitewater inquiry and the Paula Jones lawsuit that had touched off this constitutional showdown were all but forgotten. On November 13th, Bill's attorney, Bob Bennett, told Bill that Jones had agreed to drop her suit for a payment of $850,000. Although he hated to settle a case that Judge Wright had found to be without legal or factual merit, Bill decided that there was no other sure way to put this episode to rest. For weeks, I had been expecting the House Judiciary Committee to issue a raft of subpoenas, which is what was done during the 1974 Nixon impeachment inquiry. I was disgusted when Hyde announced that the committee would be calling Kenneth Starr as its main witness. Starr spoke uninterrupted for 2 hours, and then answered questions from committee members for the rest of the afternoon. It was almost 9 o'clock at night when David Kendall finally was given a chance to cross-examine Starr. David began his remarks with a summary of the process. "My task is to respond to the 2 hours of uninterrupted testimony from the independent counsel, as well as to his four-year, $45 million investigation, which has included at least 28 attorneys, 78 FBI agents, and an undisclosed number of private investigators. An investigation which has generated, by computer count, 114,532 news stories in print and 2,513 minutes of network television time, not to mention 24-hour scandal coverage on cable, a 445-page referral, 50,000 pages of documents from secret grand jury testimony, 4 hours of videotape testimony, 22 hours of audio tape, some of which was gathered in violation of state law, and the testimony of scores of witnesses, not one of whom has been cross-examined. And, David added, I have 30 minutes to do this." The next day, Sam Dash, the Office of the Independent Counsel's ethical advisor, who had appeared oblivious to previous lapses by Starr and his subordinates, resigned in protest over Starr's testimony. Dash, who had been chief counsel for the Senate Watergate Committee in 1973 and 1974, wrote a letter accusing Starr of abusing his position by unlawfully injecting himself into the impeachment process. His resignation had no apparent effect on the proceedings. Nor did an open letter issued by 400 historians that had openly urged Congress to reject impeachment because the constitutional standards for it had not been met. In early December, the vice president's father, Albert Gore Sr., died at age 91 at his home in Carthage, Tennessee. On December 8th, Bill and I flew down to Nashville for a service in the War Memorial Auditorium. There has been immense speculation about how our relationship with the Gores was affected by the impeachment scandal. Al and Tipper were as shocked and hurt as everybody else in August when Bill admitted his wrongdoing, but both were supportive throughout the ordeal, personally and politically. They were there whenever we needed them, sometimes when we asked for their help, sometimes when they sensed we could use it. Starting on December 11th, and finishing early on the 12th, the Judiciary Committee voted along party lines to refer 4 articles of impeachment to the full House for a vote. While Congress pursued impeachment, Bill focused on his official duties and I on mine. I never believed that I had the luxury of climbing into bed and pulling the covers over my head. From December 12th to 15th, Bill and I visited the Middle East. Although the Middle East presented a positive picture at the time, Bill continued to monitor closely the defiance of Saddam Hussein, who refused to agree to a resumption of UN arms inspections in Iraq. From a political point of view, this was the worst possible time for a military response to Hussein. With the impeachment vote looming, any action by the president could be challenged as an attempt to distract or delay Congress. On the other hand, if Bill put off airstrikes on Iraq, he could be accused of sacrificing national security to avoid the political heat. On December 16th, Bill's defense and intelligence advisors informed him that the time was right. Bill ordered airstrikes to knock out Iraq's known and suspected weapons of mass destruction sites and other military targets. An openly skeptical Republican leadership postponed the impeachment debate when the bombing started. Trent Lott, the Senate Republican majority leader, publicly disputed the president's judgment. "Both the timing and the policy are subject to question," he said. The House leadership was determined to force a vote on impeachment in the lame duck session before the Republican majority was reduced in January. On December 18th, as bombs fell on Iraq, the impeachment debate began. Democratic leader Congressman Dick Gebhardt asked me to meet with the House Democratic Caucus on Capitol Hill right before the scheduled votes on the articles of impeachment. Standing before the Democrats that morning, I thanked everyone for supporting the Constitution, the presidency, and the leader of their party, my husband. "You all may be mad at Bill Clinton," I said. "Certainly I'm not happy about what my husband did, but impeachment is not the answer. Too much is at stake here for us to be distracted from what really matters." I reminded them that the case for impeachment was part of a political war waged by people determined to sabotage the president's agenda on the economy, education, Social Security, health care, the environment, and the search for peace in Northern Ireland, the Balkans, and the Middle East. Everything we, as Democrats, stood for. We couldn't let it happen, and no matter how the vote went that day, Bill Clinton would not resign. This grave event was nearly upstaged by a bizarre drama on the floor of the House. The night before the voting began, Bob Livingston, the designated speaker, was exposed as an adulterer. By Saturday morning, as Livingston stood before his colleagues in the Grand House Chamber of the Capitol, everyone knew he admitted that he had, quote, strayed in his marriage. Moments after he demanded the president's resignation, amid heckles and angry shouts from the floor, he stunned everyone by resigning his position as speaker, another unintended victim of his own party's campaign of personal destruction. Like Gingrich, he left the House. Two articles were defeated, two were adopted. Bill was impeached for perjury in the grand jury and obstruction of justice. He would now be put on trial in the U.S. Senate. After the impeachment vote, a delegation of Democrats rode buses from the Capitol to the White House in a show of solidarity with the president. I linked arms with Bill as we walked out of the Oval Office to meet them in the Rose Garden. Bill thanked everyone who had stuck by him and promised not to give up. It was a strangely upbeat gathering, but I was working hard to contain the pain I felt gathering in my back. By the time the event ended and I walked back to the residence, I could hardly stand. Soon I was flat on my back and unable to move, the casualty of accumulated tension and, as it turned out, footwear. One of the White House physicians who examined me called in a physical therapist from the Navy. After the Navy therapist examined me, he asked, "Ma'am, have you been wearing high heels a lot lately?" "Yes," I replied. "Ma'am," he said, "you shouldn't wear high heels again." "Never?" "Well, yes, never." He looked at me curiously and asked, "With all due respect, ma'am, why would you want to?" It was both comforting and odd to spend the holidays doing the same things we always did, despite the specter of an impending Senate trial hovering in the room like an uninvited and unwanted guest. I received hundreds of letters of support. Among the most thoughtful was a message from Lady Bird Johnson, who had been following events from her home in Texas. Dear Hillary, you made my day. When I saw you with the president on television with you by his side, was it the South Lawn? Reminding us of the country's progress in so many areas such as education and health, and how far we have yet to go, I sent a prayer your way. Then I learned that you went to Capitol Hill to speak to Democrats and rally their support. It made me feel good, and I think that is a gauge for what a great many of our nation's citizens think. Cheers to you and admiration, Lady Bird Johnson. Lady Bird's words of experience and kindness warmed my heart. It was reassuring that someone who understood the pressures I was under recognized why I was so determined to support my husband. Once again, we spent New Year's Eve at the annual Renaissance Weekend at Hilton Head, South Carolina. The most moving tribute came from retired Admiral Elmo Zumwalt Jr., former chief of naval operations during the Vietnam War. Admiral Zumwalt gave a short speech addressed to Chelsea, entitled, "If These Were My Last Words." He wanted her never to lose sight of her father's accomplishments, even as the events in Congress threatened to overshadow them. Admiral Zumwalt also told Chelsea that her mother would be remembered for opening the eyes of the world to the rights of women and children, and for my efforts to improve their lives as well as for my support of my family in crisis. His words were an invaluable gift to Chelsea and to me. Sadly, those were the last words Chelsea would hear from Admiral Zumwalt, who died a year later. He will be remembered by his country as one of the great patriots and humanitarians of his generation, and by me and my family as a true and steadfast friend. The Senate trial began on January 7, 1999. Chief Justice William Rehnquist arrived in the Senate chamber dressed for the occasion. He wore an outfit he had designed, down to the chevrons of gold braid on its sleeves. In response to questions from the press, he said he got the idea from the costumes in a production of Gilbert and Sullivan's comic opera, Iolanthe. How fitting that he should wear a theatrical costume to preside over a political farce. I studiously avoided watching the trial on television, in part because I viewed the entire process as a colossal miscarriage of the Constitution, and partly because there was nothing I could do to affect the outcome. I had met with Bill's legal team to offer suggestions about strategy and presentation, but there wasn't much I could contribute other than my support. Because the vote to impeach in the House was considered similar to an indictment, Republican members of the House were sent to the Senate as managers or prosecutors. They were supposed to present evidence of the impeachable offenses while Bill's lawyers would defend him. As a result, the proceedings bore little resemblance to a real trial. It was more like a group tirade denouncing my husband. Throughout the 5 weeks of the spectacle, the president's lawyers made a presentation on the law and the facts that I believe historians and legal scholars will turn to when trying to understand this regrettable moment in American history. Dale Bumpers, the former senator from Arkansas, delivered a powerful argument on Bill's behalf. Bumpers, a master orator and Bill's close friend, wove together American history and Arkansas stories to deliver a compelling case in favor of acquittal. He forcefully reminded us that the Constitution was on trial. Throughout the trial, I never doubted that we would prevail in the end. I was relying more on my faith every day. It reminded me of an old saying from Sunday school. Faith is like stepping off a cliff and expecting one of two outcomes. You will either land on solid ground, or you will be taught to fly. The constitutional showdown on Capitol Hill provided an odd backdrop for the growing speculation about my entry into the New York Senate race. I still had no interest in running for Senator Moynihan's seat, but by the beginning of 1999, the Democratic leadership was waging a full-court press to change my mind. The likely GOP nominee, New York City's Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, would be a formidable opponent for any Democratic candidate. Party leaders, worried about losing a longtime Democratic seat, were intent on fielding a similarly high-profile candidate who could raise the staggering amounts of money that such a race requires. But the few friends I spoke to consistently urged me not to run. My top White House staff were also opposed. The impeachment trial was a dark cloud hanging over our family. Bill and I were struggling to repair our relationship and trying to protect Chelsea from the fallout on Capitol Hill. A conversation with Harold Ickes, an expert on New York politics, persuaded me to realize that I had to take the question of a campaign seriously. Harold's greatest asset as a friend is his candor, even bluntness. "If you think you're not going to run, then go out and issue a Sherman-esque statement," Harold said. "But if you're still mulling it over, don't say anything yet. With impeachment going on, nobody is going to press you on it right now anyway." Harold and I agreed to meet on February 12th, the date it turned out that the Senate was due to vote on impeachment. I was confident that a majority of the Senate would follow the Constitution and vote to acquit. As we awaited the inevitable outcome, I listened intently as Harold assessed the New York political landscape. As the meeting stretched over hours, Harold zeroed in on all the negatives of entering the race. I was not a New York native, had never run for office, and would face Giuliani, an intimidating opponent. No woman had ever won a statewide race in New York on her own. "I don't even know if you'd be a good candidate, Hillary," he said. I didn't know either. That afternoon, the U.S. Senate voted to acquit Bill by a wide margin. Neither charge against him received a majority of votes, let alone the required two-thirds. The vote itself was anticlimactic, causing no elation, only relief. I still hadn't decided whether to run. Harold gave me a list of 100 New Yorkers to contact, and in late February, I began calling and meeting with every one of them, beginning with Senator Moynihan and his wife Liz. Senator Moynihan offered generous public support, saying that my, quote, "magnificent, young, bright, able, Illinois-Arkansas enthusiasm would suit New York and New Yorkers. She'd be welcome and she'd win," he said. Yet plenty of others worked feverishly to discourage me. Close friends, in particular, couldn't fathom why I would consider a grueling Senate campaign after the emotional upheaval of the past few years. The treacherous waters of New York politics also caused me some concern. Knowledgeable New Yorkers bluntly advised that I could never win because I wasn't Irish or Italian, Catholic or Jewish, and an ethnic identity was imperative in such a diverse state. Another constituency that would pose an unexpected challenge was Democratic women, particularly professional women my age, who were skeptical of my motives and my decision to stay married to Bill. One benefit of my decision-making process was that Bill and I were talking again about matters other than the future of our relationship. He patiently talked over each of my concerns and carefully evaluated the odds I faced. We both knew that if I ran, I would be on my own as I had never been before. With each conversation, I found myself swinging back and forth. I needed a push. Finally, I got one. But it didn't come from a political advisor or Democratic leader. In March, I went to New York City to join tennis legend Billie Jean King at an event promoting an HBO special about women in sports. We gathered at the Lab School in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan, joined by dozens of young women athletes who were assembled on a stage adorned with a giant banner that said, "Dare to Compete," the title of the HBO film. Sophia Totti, the captain of the girls' basketball team, introduced me. As I went to shake her hand, she leaned toward me and whispered in my ear, "Dare to compete, Mrs. Clinton," she said. "Dare to compete." Her comment caught me off guard, so much so that I left the event and began to think, why am I vacillating about taking on this race? Why aren't I thinking more seriously about it? Maybe I should. Dare to compete. One afternoon in the spring, Maggie Williams and I went for a long walk. She knew time was running out on making a decision about whether I should enter the race. "I just don't know what to do," I told her. Then she weighed in. "I think it's kooky," she said. and anyone who cares about you will tell you the same thing. I think I might do it, I said. Some people had said that serving in the Senate might be a letdown after the White House, but all the issues I care about are affected by the United States Senate. If I proved to New York voters that I understood the issues that their families faced and that I was determined to work hard for them, I believed that I could win. On April 20th, two students at Columbine High School in Colorado opened fire on their classmates. 12 students and one teacher died in the massacre. The Columbine tragedy ignited a call for more federal action to keep guns out of the hands of the violent, troubled, and young, a lethal combination. Bill and I convened an event attended by 40 members of Congress from both parties to announce a White House proposal to raise the legal age of handgun ownership to 21 and to limit purchases of handguns to one per month. Despite the public outcry, the Congress failed to act on two simple other measures: to close the so-called gun show loophole that allows people to buy guns without background checks, and to require child safety locks on guns. The Senate race began to take shape. Mayor Giuliani labeled me a carpetbagger and announced that he would go to Arkansas to raise money for his campaign. A clever ploy, I thought, one that raised him both attention and money, and gave me a taste of the campaign to come. In June, I took the first concrete steps for a Senate campaign, announcing that I would form an exploratory committee. During the White House years, I had often escaped to New York City with my mother or Chelsea to take in Broadway shows, museum exhibits, or just to visit friends. Even before I contemplated running for the Senate, the state had been on the top of our short list of places to live after Bill's term ended. This desire grew over the years and now hardened into a firm decision. We had already talked about buying a house, and before long, we were house hunting. But this ordinarily routine process was complicated by the security concerns of the Secret Service. We couldn't live on certain kinds of streets, and any house we bought had to have space for security personnel. Eventually, we found the perfect place: an old farmhouse and barn in Chappaqua, north of New York City in Westchester County. I also started reaching out to potential contributors for the first time on my own behalf. At a major Democratic Party fundraiser in Washington on June 7, 1999, Bill and I were welcomed on stage by former Texas Governor Ann Richards, whose sharp wit and homespun humor were legendary on the political circuit. She said in her deep Texas drawl, "Hillary Clinton, the next junior senator from New York, and of course, her lovely husband Bill. Man, I bet he's really going to shake up that Senate Spouses Club." Bill accepted the good-natured teasing and delighted in the public support I was receiving. It would be awkward for him to watch from the sidelines, but he gave me unconditional and enthusiastic support as his wife and as a candidate. I received a boost in late June from another unexpected source: Father George Tribu, the priest who had run the Catholic Boys High School in Little Rock for many years. He had become a friend of mine even though he disagreed with my pro-choice position. He had stayed overnight in the White House, and I had arranged for him to meet His Holiness Pope John Paul II during the papal visit to St. Louis in 1999. Father Tribu wrote me a letter dated June 24, 1999. "Dear Hillary, I want to tell you what I have been telling students for 50 years. It is my opinion that on Judgment Day, the first question God asks is not about the Ten Commandments, although he gets to them later, but what he asks each of us is this: what did you do with the time and the talents I gave you? Those who feel you are not up to handling the hostile New York press and the taunts of your opponents fail to realize that having been tried in the fire, you can handle anything. Bottom line, run, Hillary, run. My prayers will be with you all the way." The most difficult decisions I have made in my life were to stay married to Bill and to run for the Senate from New York. By now I knew I wanted our marriage to last, if it could, because I loved Bill and I realized how much I cherished the years we had spent together. I hoped Bill and I could grow old together. We were both committed to rebuilding our marriage with the tools of our faith, love, and shared past. With my mind clearer about where I wanted to go with Bill, I felt freer to take the first steps toward a race for the Senate. On July 7th, on Senator Moynihan's beautiful 900-acre farm in Pinder's Corners, with the senator by my side, I announced that I was forming an official campaign committee in anticipation of running for the United States Senate. To the more than 200 reporters on hand for the occasion, I spoke briefly about issues that mattered to me and to New York, and I acknowledged the legitimacy of questions about my running from a state where I had never lived. I said, "I think that's a very fair question, and I fully understand people raising it, and I think I have some real work to do to get out and listen and learn from the people of New York and demonstrate that what I'm for is maybe as important, if not more important, than where I'm from." A few minutes later, Senator Moynihan and I walked back to his farmhouse for a brunch of ham and biscuits. Soon I was on my way. I had expected hurdles as a rookie candidate, and I certainly encountered some, but I never imagined how much I would enjoy the campaign. From the moment I left Senator Moynihan's farm to begin my listening tour in July 1999, I was captivated by the places I visited and the people I met throughout New York. New Yorkers, with their resilience, diversity, and passion for the future, represented everything I treasured about America. In particular, New York City's diverse communities are living reminders that the city symbolizes America's unique promise to the rest of the world, a fact that would be tragically underscored on September 11, 2001, when Manhattan was attacked by terrorists who hated and feared the freedom, diversity, and choices that America represents. Balancing the requirements of the campaign with my obligations as First Lady presented a unique challenge. Doing two jobs at once tested both the White House staff and the dedicated team of campaign aides working on the Senate race in New York. The campaign was not idyllic. The worst instance came during an official visit to Israel in the fall of 1999, when I attended an event as First Lady with Suha Arafat, wife of the Palestinian leader. Mrs. Arafat spoke before me in Arabic. Listening to an Arabic-to-English translation through headphones, neither I nor other members of our delegation, including U.S. Embassy staff, Middle East experts, and respected American Jewish leaders, heard her outrageous remark suggesting that Israel had used poison gas to control Palestinians. When I went on stage moments later to deliver my remarks, Mrs. Arafat greeted me with an embrace, a traditional greeting. Had I been aware of her hateful words, I would have been able to denounce them on the spot. The New York tabloids ran cover photos of me receiving a kiss on the cheek from Suha Arafat, with accompanying stories about her remarks. Many Jewish voters were understandably upset. My campaign eventually overcame the fallout, but I had learned a hard lesson about the hazards of merging my role in the international diplomatic arena with the complexities of local New York politics. As unnerving as it was to find my footing, I tried to stay focused on getting to know the people of New York and letting them get a sense of me. My goal was to visit all 62 counties, and for more than a year, I traveled New York State in a Ford conversion van nicknamed the HRC Speedwagon. I stopped at diners and cafes along the road, just as Bill and I had always done during his campaigns. To me, it was the best way to stay in touch with people's personal concerns. I finally felt that I was starting to connect to voters. When I first began campaigning, people came out to see me in large numbers. This was not necessarily a groundswell of support. Rather, the crowd viewed me as a curiosity. After I became a more familiar presence, people began to care less about where I was from than what I was for. Learning about the variety and complexity of the state's political terrain was important to me, and so was reaching out to women, some of whom were disappointed or offended that I had stayed married to Bill. I hoped that they would understand that I had to make a decision that was right for me and my family. I didn't want to give speeches to explain such a private part of myself. I attended small gatherings at the homes of women supporters in different parts of the state. Away from the camera lights and the political reporters, I answered questions about my marriage, about why I moved to New York, health care, child care, and whatever else was on their minds. Gradually, most women who were otherwise inclined to support me seemed willing to accept my decision to stay with Bill, even if they would have chosen differently. In February 2000, I formally declared my candidacy, and later Chelsea joined our Speedwagon crew to campaign for me whenever she could. I was so proud of the young woman she had become, and so grateful that she had emerged from 8 trying years as a kind, caring person with her head on straight. I am very lucky to be her mother. In mid-May, I was formally nominated as the United States Senate candidate from New York at the State Democratic Convention in Albany. Shortly after, a seismic shift rattled the New York political landscape. Mayor Giuliani announced his withdrawal from the Senate race after being diagnosed with prostate cancer and following news reports about his long-running extramarital affair. I took no pleasure in this ironic twist, knowing all too well the private pain for everyone involved. The mayor's departure was not a welcome relief. By the time his campaign ended, I was 8 or 10 points ahead according to public opinion polls. Now I had to start over with a brand new opponent, Congressman Rick Lazio. My campaign left little time for anything else in my life. When I did break away, it was either for official White House events or, sadly, for what seemed to be a never-ending procession of memorial services for friends and colleagues. John F. Kennedy Jr., his wife Carolyn, and her sister Lauren died tragically in a private plane crash off Martha's Vineyard the previous summer. Bill always felt great affection for John, whom we had gotten to know in private gatherings at his mother's home on the vineyard and at public events. We wanted John and his sister Caroline and her children to feel free to visit us in the White House. After he was married, John brought his bride, Carolyn, for a personal tour. When he saw that Bill was using his father's desk in the Oval Office, it stirred a faint memory in him of playing beneath it and peeking through its small inset door while President Kennedy made phone calls. In March, my friend Diane Blair was diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer. Over the next few months, Bill and I flew to Fayetteville, Arkansas several times to be with Diane and Jim. When Jim called in June to tell me the end was near, I left the campaign behind and flew to see Diane for the last time. As I got ready to leave, I bent down to kiss her goodbye. She pressed my hand tightly and whispered to me, "Don't ever give up on yourself and what you believe in. Take care of Bill and Chelsea. They need you, and win this election for me. I wish I could be there when you do. I love you." Then Bill and Chelsea joined me at her bedside. She looked intently at us. "Remember," she said. "Remember what?" Bill asked. "Just remember," she said. 5 days later, she died. Bill, Chelsea, and I later flew to Fayetteville for a memorial service that celebrated Diane's extraordinary life. Presiding at the celebration, I said that Diane squeezed more out of her too brief life than any of us could have done in 300 or 400 years. I don't know anyone who tried harder and had more success at living. On July 11th, Bill began a 2-week meeting at Camp David with Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat in an effort to resolve outstanding issues in the ongoing peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians under the Oslo Accords. Unfortunately, while Barak came to Camp David to make peace, Arafat did not. At noon on July 25th, Bill announced the close of the unsuccessful Camp David summit, acknowledging the deep disappointment he felt and urging both sides never to give up hope of finding a just, lasting, and comprehensive peace. By August 2000, it was time for the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles. Bill and I addressed the delegates on the first night, August 14th, and then left the city, making room for Vice President Gore and his vice presidential pick, Senator Joe Lieberman, to accept the nomination and take center stage. Within days, I began to prepare for 3 upcoming debates against Congressman Lazio. A young, telegenic Republican from Long Island, Lazio enjoyed strong support in the suburbs, He presented himself as the anti-Hillary candidate, running a negative campaign for most of the summer. Our first debate was in Buffalo on September 13th and was moderated by a Buffalo native, Tim Russert, of NBC's Meet the Press. In the spring, I had called for a ban on all soft money, but I wasn't going to commit to it unilaterally. The Republicans had refused to forswear the use of soft money from outside groups, including many busily raising $32 million in support of Lazio's Senate bid. Near the end of the debate, Lazio began hectoring me about soft money and challenging me to ban it in my campaign. I could barely get a word in when he marched over to me, waving a piece of paper called the New York Freedom from Soft Money Pact and demanding my signature. I declined. He pressed in closer, shouting, "Right here, sign it right now." The debate was a turning point in the race. A lot of voters, especially women, were offended by Lazio's tactics. Late in the campaign, on October 12th, the USS Cole was attacked by terrorists in Yemen. The powerful explosion killed 17 American sailors. This attack, like the embassy bombings, was later traced to Al-Qaeda. I canceled my campaign events to go with Bill and Chelsea to Norfolk Naval Station in Virginia for the memorial service. I had met with the families of the American embassy bombing victims in August of 1998. Now I offered condolences to the families of our murdered sailors, young men and women, who were serving their country and providing security in a critical region of the world. I despise terrorism and the nihilism it represents, and I was incredulous when the New York Republican Party and the Lazio campaign insinuated that I was somehow involved with the terrorists who blew up the coal. They made this despicable charge in a television ad and in an automatic telephone message directed to hundreds of thousands of New York voters 12 days before the election. The story that they had concocted was that I had received a donation from somebody who belonged to a group that they said supported terrorists. It was sickening. By the final weeks of the campaign, I began to feel confident that I would win. I worked up until the last minute. On election day, November 7th, Bill and Chelsea voted with me at our local polling station, Douglas Grafflin Elementary School in Chappaqua. After seeing Bill's name on ballots for years, I was humbled and honored to see my own. As the results came in during the evening, it was clear that I was going to win by a much bigger margin than expected, 55% to 43%. Hard work had paid off, and I was grateful for the chance to represent New York and to contribute to our nation in a new role. The presidential race, meanwhile, was a roller coaster. Little did we know at the time that 36 days would elapse before the country learned who the new president would be. The uncertainty in the presidential race tempered my elation on election night, but it did nothing to subdue the joyful victory party at the Grand Hyatt Hotel near Grand Central Terminal in New York City. I was overwhelmed by the generosity and openness of New Yorkers who got to know me and took a chance on me. I joined Bill, Chelsea, my mother, and scores of supporters in a deluge of confetti and balloons. Dozens of hugs and handshakes later, I stood at the podium to thank my supporters. I told them, 62 counties, 16 months, 3 debates, 2 opponents, and 6 black pantsuits later, because of you, we are here. After 8 years with a title, but no portfolio, I was now senator-elect. In the end, Al Gore won the popular vote by over 500,000 ballots, but he lost the presidency in the Electoral College. The Supreme Court voted 5-4 on December 12th to stop a recount of votes in Florida, effectively sealing the victory for Bush. Seldom, if ever, in our history has the people's right to choose their elected officials been thwarted by such a blatant abuse of judicial power. Bill and I were concerned what a return to the failed Republican policies of the past might mean for our nation. My only comfort was that I would soon have the opportunity to use my voice and vote on behalf of the values and policies I thought best for New York and America. On January 3rd, I stepped onto the floor of the Senate to swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. When I turned and looked to the gallery above me, I saw my mother, my daughter, and my husband, smiling at the newest senator from New York. 3 days later, we held a farewell party under a big tent on the South Lawn for everyone who had worked or volunteered in the White House over the previous 8 years. In a surprise that Capricia had arranged, the curtain on stage rose and Fleetwood Mac emerged from the wings. When the band broke into the opening chords of Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, the anthem of Bill's 1992 campaign, the crowd erupted in a loud, joyous, and off-key chorus wailing the refrain. I had taken those lyrics to heart. It may have been a cliché, but the phrase that best summed up my political philosophy was, it's always about the future, about what must be done to make America safer, smarter, stronger, richer, and better, and how Americans can prepare to compete and cooperate in a global community. For the next 2 weeks, I wandered from room to room, taking mental snapshots of all my favorite things in the White House, trying to recapture the wonder I felt when I first arrived. I lingered in Chelsea's rooms and tried to hear in my mind the laughter of her friends and the sound of her music. She had grown from a child to a young woman right in this place. Every morning and every evening, I found myself sinking into my favorite chair in the West Sitting Hall, a comfortable retreat where for 8 years I had welcomed Chelsea home after school, met with staff, gossiped with friends, read books, and collected my thoughts. Now I just reveled in this extraordinary time and this extraordinary place, watching the sunlight stream through the glorious fan-shaped window. Many times over the last few weeks, I thought back to Bill's first inauguration in 1993, an event that seemed as vivid as yesterday and as remote as a lifetime ago. Chelsea and I took one last walk down to the children's garden, hidden by the tennis court, where the grandchildren of presidents left their handprints in the cement. Outside on the South Lawn, Bill and I looked out over the fence to the Washington Monument as we had countless times before. Bill threw tennis balls for Buddy to chase, while Sox kept his distance. The White House staff prepared for the arrival of the new first family on January 20th. For the 43rd time in our nation's history, Americans would witness the peaceful transfer of power, as one presidency came to a close and another began. When we entered the grand foyer for the last time as occupants of the People's House, the permanent staff had gathered to say farewell. I thanked the florist for the flowers she artfully placed in every room, the kitchen staff for the special meals they faithfully prepared, the housekeepers for their daily attention to detail, the grounds crew for their careful tending of the gardens, and all the other dedicated staff whose hard work graced the White House every day. Buddy Carter, the veteran White House butler, received my last goodbye embrace and turned it into a joyous dance. We skipped and twirled across the marble floor. My husband cut in, taking me in his arms as we waltzed together down the long hall. Then I said goodbye to the house where I had spent 8 years. Living history.
Living History was written and read by Hillary Rodham Clinton. It was abridged for audio by George Truitt. It was recorded at Interface Studio in Washington, D.C., with editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Sarah Ginsberg. Living History was produced and directed by Susan Perrin. Letters from John F. Kennedy Jr. and Mrs. Lyndon Johnson used with permission. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Living History is available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.